Welcome to the Expert Speak, a service of the Florida Psychiatric Society. I'm Abby Strauss, and thanks for listening.
There is a great emphasis on how to accurately diagnose depression, but many of the standard measuring tools either don't ask or underplay the impact of culture and ethnicity. Daniel Jimenez is a psychologist at the University of Miami Department of Psychiatry, and he has done considerable work in this area, especially with Latinos. He graciously agrees to spend some time with us this morning to discuss these changes. Dr. Jimenez, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Many people tend to clump together the concept of a Latino and perhaps interchange the word with Hispanic. But there are cultural differences. Those from Mexico are not necessarily the same as those from the islands, and even those in the islands vary a lot. For clarification, is there a difference between a Latino and a Hispanic? Could you just give us a little bit of background on that?
Sure. The term Hispanic is a census term, and it's used to lump everybody from Latin America together, and it really doesn't capture differences that occur between the folks in the Caribbean and the folks in Central America and the folks in South America. For some, it also connotes a sense of colonialism or imperial past that is negative. In my experience here in the eastern part of the United States, when I've worked with Cubans or Puerto Ricans or even Dominicans, they've used the term Hispanic just as a descriptor of their ethnic background and then go on to proceed to tell me where specifically they are from. But when I've worked in Texas and in California and I've worked with much more Mexican and Central American folks, they tend to prefer the term Latino because it has less of a imperial stigma, if you will. But it also gives them a much more, I would say, broader sense of where they come from and of their background and of their Spanish-speaking heritage, but not without having to really go into the imperialism when Spain came and did what they did with the Native Americans. Within that, there is a lot of variation, and that is not really captured by the terms Hispanic or even Latino, because what you said is very correct. Those in Mexico are very, very different in terms of how they speak Spanish, what they eat, their cultural traditions, even if they are Catholic. So you have that, and then compare that to, let's say, Cubans, and while we may eat rice and beans, how we cook the beans and how we cook the rice are vastly different. How we speak Spanish is vastly different. The terms we use for various things are different. It's similar saying that the people in England are the same as Americans, where we know fundamentally that that is not accurate and that is not a true statement.
In your clinical work, are there differences based on these different cultural and ethnic divisions?
Yes, I would say that. For instance, when I was working with Mexicans, how they view mental illness is slightly different, and how they view the etiology of the mental illness is slightly different. There is a notion of how migration interferes or plays a role in the etiology of mental illness that is a very similar, it's a very familiar tale when you're talking about whether somebody has Alzheimer's or whether somebody is depressed. And when you talk to somebody that's Cuban or even Puerto Rican, they feel like it's much less of a tale of migration and much more of a being away from the family or being isolated socially that has to do with the etiology of mental illness. So how they view mental illness and how they view the development of mental illness changes from sub-ethnicities, I would say. It might, and this isn't something that's empirically tested, but it's something that I've seen clinically in speaking with individuals from various Latin American countries.
So is there, if you can generalize, and you're suggesting that it is hard to generalize, but is there a difference in the form or the intensity or the age of onset of depression in the elderly Latino versus the average non-Hispanic American? I don't want to confuse it, but I'm looking for differences between the groups.
I wouldn't say that there is a difference between the groups within the Latino community. I wouldn't say that there is a difference. Well, actually, that's not necessarily true. There is a difference in the prevalence rate of depression and anxiety when you start breaking it down between ethnicities, like when you start breaking it down between the separate Latino ethnicities, and you find much higher rates of mental illness, specifically depression, in Mexicans versus Cubans. What we find also is that the rates of, say, heart disease are higher amongst Cubans than amongst Mexicans. And then asthma is very high in Puerto Ricans. Depending on the sub-ethnicity, the problems are different. And so we generally tend to lump everyone together to show that this is a widespread problem amongst this population. But when we start breaking it down, we start saying, like, well, it's much more of an issue with Cubans versus others, or it's much more of a problem amongst Puerto Ricans than amongst others.
One of the things that struck me, and is very interesting and very intriguing, is that there had been comments made that the longer that a Latino lives in the United States, the more likely that they are to develop a depression. So that immediately presents to me the question, are we simply giving them a freedom to express a depression, admit to the depression? Are they copying our ways? Is there any truth to that observation?
Yes, we are seeing that. And we are seeing that not only with depression, with other disorders like heart disease. The more acculturated they get, if you will, the more we're seeing the rise of these illnesses. And frankly, the literature is not very clear as to the reason why this happens. People have said that when they start acclimating to American diets, that's when they start getting the diabetes or the heart disease, because the traditional Mexican foods are heavy in vegetables. Unfortunately, I cannot comment on why this is happening. In the United States, these things happen, and in regard to mental illness specifically, it follows the same path. There isn't a clear reason as to why this is happening. If you follow what the patients are saying in terms of the etiology of the illness, maybe there is some truth to some of the social isolation that they may feel as they get older in a foreign country. The differences, their ability to interact, they might start feeling even more marginalized.
So what can we do to help these folks? They come to us, they're depressed, or somebody thinks they're depressed. How do we go about properly intervening with someone who brings so many other variables to the table?
Getting to understand how they view what is going on. So if we're talking about mental illness, I think it's fundamentally important to get to understand what it is that they actually believe is mental illness, or what they actually believe is the cause of mental illness. And also to get a better understanding as to what they believe is adequate treatment for mental illness. So, for instance, when I've been working with these folks, repeatedly I get a notion of there's a stigma towards talk therapy or traditional psychotherapy and even taking medications. When asking them, what do you think then is a proper treatment for somebody who feels this way? And then you go on to describe how they use their term for depression or anxiety. And without a doubt, I always get keeping the mind active and also keeping the body physically active is of utmost importance. I've gotten that wherever I've gone, whether it be in California, Texas, Massachusetts, or here, I've always gotten that same response. And so what's important, or what's most important to them, is engaging in a sort of physical activity that would help them distract the mind, or would actually get them moving so that they're not constantly ruminating, or that it gets them out of the house so they're not just in the same rut, if you will, over and over again. Meeting them there and then intervening at that level, I think, would be the most important first step.
And what about religion? A lot of these folks come from very real, strong religious backgrounds, either Catholicism or even to the other side, voodoo, perhaps.
Right.
How does this roll into what are the necessary steps to intervene, taking these as possibilities?
Your point is very valid, and we as mental health professionals should not shy away from including some of their belief systems into treatment. So, for instance, if somebody has anxiety or is depressed and they have a very deep religious belief, whether it be voodoo or whether it be Santeria or whether it be Catholicism, I think it's important to find a way to incorporate that into the treatment. So it might be in the form of a pleasant event schedule where we ask them to actually engage in an activity within the church, or it might be in terms of praying that they find a certain comfort in praying. And so we try to build that into their daily routine. They find pleasure in that. One of the keys to depression is this anhedonia. So if we can find something, and if this religion provides them with that sense of enjoyment, or we're able to find something that allows them to start enjoying a bit more of life, I think it's supremely important. And I should say, by the way, if it hasn't come across yet, I'm a very behaviorally oriented psychologist, so my bias comes out in that regard.
And I agree with you, especially when we're looking at the cultural background. I know people who are Puerto Rican, and I was told about how a lot of times people will do things, and then if they fail with some voodoo ritual or other superstitious ritual, they can fall into a depression. One of the things that struck me, and I was told this, is that in certain parts of the Caribbean, if you wanted to have someone leave your home because you didn't like them, you put kernels of corn under the rug, and that would make the people leave. So the question comes, if the person didn't leave and they got depressed, if they were brought to an American emergency room because they were depressed, they might be considered as delusional, but they're not. And this isn't even being taken into consideration most of the time. I think this is what's so rich about talking to you about this, is that there is a, I'm going to say, a shadow diagnosis that needs to be looked at and not ignored. And oftentimes it's not medication, it's behavioral stuff. So I agree with you. How does a doctor really address this here in the United States? Are we training our people to address these?
That's a good question. Recently, I spent 2 weeks in an inpatient psychiatric ward here. And when we would discuss delusions, at least in this context, we would always make sure to find out the nature of those delusions, whether they were religious in nature or whether they were just other, if you will. And then within that religious delusion, or if we called it a delusion, we had to really make sure that they weren't just saying that they are Jesus. We tried to delve more into sort of the nature of the religiosity of the concerns. It becomes very tricky to parcel it out. From my experience here, that yes, at the resident level, there is that teaching. When I was in graduate school, that wasn't too heavily talked about. It definitely needs to be more widespread. When we are talking about people of a different culture and they have a vastly differing beliefs than the more widespread culture, then we really need to really start delving a bit more. And that needs to be taught more, I think, widespread in medical school and in residency and also in graduate school for psychologists that are going to be dealing with these individuals. That sort of training, it would be helpful not only for people dealing with Latinos, but also when dealing with African Americans, because as a whole tend to be very religiously oriented, and sort of figure out what is the nature of their religious beliefs, and are these delusions really bizarre? They are delusions, in fact, or are they just a system of beliefs that because of something that didn't happen or something that did happen over the course of their religious exercise that caused them to feel a certain way?
This speaks to the importance of, if an elderly person, and maybe English is not their first language, to have a child there or another family member there who can help make sure that the verbiage is understood, but also to act as a mediator for the cultural background. How often this is not done in most mental health evaluations.
The importance of a family member there, both as a mediator or translator, to really accurately translate what the doctor is saying to how the person would understand what the doctor is saying, is of utmost importance. And it also speaks to the point that the Latinos as a whole now are very much family oriented. And now I am speaking in generalities, so forgive me, but this doesn't apply to every single Latino, but as a whole, they tend to be very family oriented. And so decisions are not, especially medical or psychiatric decisions, are not made in isolation. It's not just the patient, it is the family. And so having somebody there to facilitate that understanding would be supremely important. At the very least, if a family member or even a friend could not be there, to have a translator that can not just translate word for word, but to really translate what the construct is getting at, if that makes any sense. You're just not going to ask, you know, when we say feeling blue, and if you were to translate that into Spanish, it's azul, and that means nothing. How do I feel a color? But in English, that means something very real. In Spanish, that doesn't mean anything. It's really trying to understand what the point of feeling blue means. What does that mean in Spanish to get them to understand, like, how deep is my depression or how poorly do I feel emotionally?
It really is not part of the standard depression scale or so many of the scales that they don't even go near this. It must frustrate you so much.
We have a problem that one of the most widely used measures, the CESD, let's say, that has so many issues in terms of using the Spanish version. As an English measure, it's a very good measure. And when you use a Spanish measure, the variability between person to person is so large that it almost becomes a useless measure. So it's really trying to understand how we can accurately measure this is very important. When I speak, I sometimes run into, yeah, of course, this is common sense or something like that, but in the real world, these types of things aren't being done. These types of considerations aren't being thought of. I do run into that quite a bit.
It's very interesting because what we're saying is that quite often the manifestation or what looks like a depression is more than the symptoms. We need to know the symbolism and the core. Too many of us just look at 10 different symptoms and make measurements accordingly and completely miss what you're talking about. And what you're talking about is critical.
Right. And so I think we just look for what's on the checklist without really thinking about why is this person or why does this person think he or she is depressed? It's not going back into, oh, in my childhood, this happened. It's more of a how does this person understand what is going on? And then meeting them there. And then from there, instead of just, well, we're going to engage you in the talk therapy, because that may not jive with what they think is going on. But instead, really critically thinking of a way to engage them in mental health care that is non-stigmatizing, is culturally acceptable, and at the same time, gives them the buy-in that they need to then further engage, not just in the one session, but going forward.
You made a very interesting point when you used the word that it's non-stigmatizing. That rings in my head as being particularly true.
Right. Stigma is such a big issue. As soon as we start talking about mental illness, in particular with the Latino population, we start hearing I'm not crazy. No. And I was even told by a patient of mine one time, because I tried to engage her when I was in training, I tried to engage her in talk therapy, and she goes, "You Americans always think that the answer is talking about problems." That's when the light really turned on, and I was like, maybe translating CBT isn't the best way of going about this. They may be unwilling to sit there for 50 minutes, but they might be willing to engage in a certain activity, or they may be more willing to engage in exercise, let's say, and start getting them out of that depression first, and then we could start, once they start feeling better, maybe start introducing some of these topics that are other ways to treat mental illness. Is supremely important. What's also important is to normalize the experience of mental illness, in the sense that mental illness is a disease much like diabetes is, much like heart disease, and it's something that they can understand. When we're talking about mental illness, they don't feel like that they are crazy, that they just feel like they're sick, just like you would getting a cold or just like you would getting diabetes or something like that.
Daniel Jimenez is a psychologist at the University of Miami Department of Psychiatry. Sir, thank you very much. Very interesting. And I'd like to get back with you someday to talk about voodoo and some of the more intense things that we see. But doesn't represent everybody, but it's fascinating. I thank you for joining us.
Oh, sure. I thank you. I was happy to do this.